Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and spiders are everywhere this time of year. They invade our warm houses, they dangle from large artificial webs designed to startle trick-or-treaters, and we all encounter spiders all the time, year-round, of course. But what a lot of us know about them is actually wrong. Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis is here today to help us take an in-depth look at spiders and explode some spider mythology along the way. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Now, we're stepping outside your area of expertise because normally we talk about insects, right?
You know, when you understand critters that have six legs, it's not a far stretch to have to work on critters that have eight legs. So as an entomologist, I get enough spider questions that I've had to learn over the years as much as I could about them.
All right. Well, we encounter a lot of spiders. What are some of the more common spiders that we do see in our homes and around this time of year?
Well, we just finished the time of year when we see the orb weaver spiders. Those are the spiders that we find outdoors, strung between the corn plants, strung between the grasses alongside the road. They make a web that is what you would call a typical spider web. It's made of radiating lines and concentric circles. So we just came through the season of the garden spider, the cat-faced spider, the marbled spider. There are several in that group that make that kind of web. Year-round, we also see the large brown wolf spider. Wolf spider is an active hunter. They don't make a web and wait for food to come to them. They go out and chase their food like a wolf. They run after it, they pounce on it, they eat it that way. So that one's a year-round. But we're also at that time of the year when we're likely to see grass spiders moving into the house. Those are sort of a really skinny, long-bodied spider. I mean, they're still only half an inch long, but they're very slender from side to side. And then year-round, we also see cellar spiders in our house. That's the one that is in the rafters of your basement, just sort of quietly hanging out there. So that covers the basic ones that we're likely to see, kind of depending on time of year.
So with the orb weavers, because they've been so visible in recent weeks, and it's so beautiful in the mornings when you go out for a walk and you see those the dew on the webs and the sun glinting off of it, mm-hmm. What are they doing during that season when they are so visible?
Well, they have been here all year, but this is the time of the year when they reach maturity and their webs become much larger for us to see. And those webs generally last overnight, and during that time, some food, that is another insect, a grasshopper, a fly, something will have bumped into that web and got tangled, and the spider ran out, paralyzed it, wrapped it up, and then will later slowly consume the liquid contents of that particular prey. Come the next morning, that web is probably pretty useless, so they will spend the day tearing it down, eating the silk, recycling it to build another web to catch more food. And all of this is building up to laying eggs in an egg sac that will spend the winter so we can start the season next year with little baby spiderlings.
Where do they put those egg sacs? We don't see them as visibly. Where do they hide them?
Some spiders do hide them, and other spiders make it quite obvious. The cellar spider that's in the rafters of your basement, you can see the little white cocoons. They look like little silk bags. They're just there in the web. The case of the wolf spider, she actually carries that sack of eggs with her until they start to hatch, and she may even carry the baby spiderlings for a while. With the garden spiders and those other orb weavers, my assumption is they're just down in the debris. They've dropped them down in the grass where they'll have a little protection from the winter weather.
All right. And then most of the spiders that we've seen during the fall weeks, do they expire as soon as it gets cold?
They either die of old age or freezing. That isn't true of all spiders. They have the ability to hibernate through the winter, just like insects do that are adapted to our climate. But those very large spiders that we observed at the end of the fall, they were at the end of their life, and they have done what they needed to do to perpetuate the species, and they have either died of old age or they will with the freeze.
So the ones that make their way into our houses, Does the winter affect them, or can they just sort of happily live alongside us all winter long?
It's a little of both. There are spiders like wolf spiders and fishing spiders that get into our houses, and there's not enough for them to eat, and it's a little too dry inside, and so they probably don't do well. They would have been better off in their survival if they had stayed outside rather than come inside. But then there are the ones like the sac spiders that are in our house all year. They're the ones you see frequently at the junction between the wall and the ceiling. Sometimes they make a little silk retreat up there. And the long-bodied cellar spider is there year-round. So it's a little bit of both. But things like grass spiders that enter by accident probably aren't going to be very happy for very long because of the inside conditions.
All right. Now, a lot of us are really freaked out by spiders, and we have a lot of things that we think we know about spiders being dangerous or nefarious for different reasons. So the common spiders that we've talked about so far, are any of them dangerous to people?
No, they're not. The first thing to remember is we are not a food source for spiders. They're not out to get us. They are not out to encase us in their webbing and try to use us as a food source. They are going to try to get away from you if they can. When the rare spider bite does happen, it's usually because the spider is confined and trapped or threatened in some way. But the ones we've mentioned are not dangerous. Yes, there may be a reaction if you could force one of them to bite you, but it's not going to be lethal. It's not going to be dangerous. It's not going to cause you any significant harm.
We hear some thoughts about spiders creeping into our mouths when we sleep. You want to talk about that
yeah.
myth there? I mean, children love to tell you that you eat six bugs a night or six spiders a night or
yeah.
something like that.
So, well, if you're going to lie, you might as well get it right. It's eight spiders.
Oh, eight.
Eight spiders that we allegedly eat. And this is a funny story. To look this up on web, go to somewhere like Snoops.com, one of the fact-checking places, and look this up, because it's an interesting story of how this was a lie made up out of thin air way back in about 1954. And then it was a book of things that are just so weird you wouldn't believe, and we shouldn't.
Right.
And in 1993, a scientist put this lie on the web as an example of the kinds of things that people will believe that aren't true. Well, the irony is, by putting it on the web as a lie, it became a fact. And so it's kind of this interesting story of how it backfired. But there is no truth that we eat spiders. It doesn't fit the spider biology. It doesn't match our biology. They're not going to come out and crawl down your throat at night while you sleep. So rest easy. They're not out to get you.
All right. There are some spiders that are dangerous. We hear quite a bit about the brown recluse spider. What are the dangerous spiders that we might encounter in Iowa?
In Iowa, the only one you're really likely to encounter is the brown recluse spider. And it has been recorded in Iowa, about 30 different counties where we have found it. But we are at the northern extreme of its range. They do not live outdoors. Brown recluse might be in your shed because you transported it in, but it's not going to survive the winter outside. We think most of the recoveries of the brown recluse spider, especially in the center of the state, were introduced. So you brought something in, you carried some package, some machinery arrived, and there was a spider from the south that was in there as well. So brown recluse spider can happen in the state. It doesn't happen often. Brown recluse spider is the one that is misdiagnosed, misunderstood, misidentified more than any other, in large part because of the false information, again, that's on the internet. When you look at a picture on the internet and someone says, whoa, I have a brown recluse spider bite, it's probably not true.
All right. But if you do encounter a brown recluse spider, they are quite dangerous, right?
They're dangerous in that their venom, if they do bite you, again, out of threat or being handled or being squeezed against your skin for some reason, the venom that they inject causes necrosis. It causes an area of your skin to die. So you will have this ulcer. You will have this sore that could get worse over time, but it's not fatal. It's ugly and it's not a fun thing to go through, but it's not going to kill you either.
All right. The black widow spider, that's another one people like to be very afraid of. Tell me a little bit about them.
We can have that one as well. Both the black widow and the brown recluse live up to their names, and I'm going to pick on the recluse especially. They are reclusive. They're not going to be out wandering around looking for you. They're going to be in a dark, secluded, quiet location, a corner or behind boxes and behind the water heater or someplace like that, where they can stay hidden and wait for food to come to them. We do have black widow spiders in Iowa. They show up occasionally as well. That one does cause a little more problem, but it's a very low percentage of people who are confirmed to be bitten by black widow spiders ever have complications beyond the initial bite.
All right. Now, even though we now know all of this information about spiders, people are still freaked out by them, Donald. Do you have any advice for coexisting a little more peacefully with spiders? Because they really do benefit us in a lot of ways, right?
They do. They're all beneficial. All spiders are predators that are feeding on other critters, things that we don't want in the house, things that we may not want in the garden. So all spiders are beneficial. We should be grateful for that. But as you know, I've spent the last 42 years telling people that house centipedes are also beneficial.
And how's that going?
And I can't tell that it's made a bit of difference to people's attitude towards something that has too many legs. And when you ask people, why are you afraid of spiders? There's, oh, I might get bitten. But the big answer is they're just creepy. And I think it's the legs. Maybe it's the long legs. Maybe it's the fact that they're kind of secretive. You see it out of the corner of your eye, and then it moves, and it startles you. But no, we should love spiders. We should be grateful for the biological control services they provide. And I'll keep telling you that, but I'm not sure it's going to make much of an impact.
All right. And if you have spiders in your house and you don't want spiders in your house, what's your recommendation?
Vacuum frequently, vacuum thoroughly, vacuum as many of the spider habitats as you can. Your vacuum cleaner with the crevice tool attached is your best spider control indoors.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Donald Lewis, Iowa State University professor of entomology. We've been talking about spiders, and in just a moment, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Giron will join us, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We've started off the hour with arachnids. Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis is here. And of course, he's happy to answer any more spider questions you may have and other insects you encounter. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron is also here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kevin is on the line in Cedar Rapids with an insect question for you, Donald. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. I have heard that daddy longleg spiders are very poisonous, but that their fangs aren't long enough to penetrate skin. I'm just curious if that's actually true.
As near as we can tell, no. That's another one of those myths that was started probably, what's the craziest thing we could say that everybody would believe? And the daddy long legs, they do have venom. They use venom for catching their prey, but it's not any more toxic than any other, and they're less likely to bite you. So enjoy daddy long legs wherever you see them and just leave them there.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Kevin. Next up, Christine in Storm Lake. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about moving perennials. It has nothing to do with insects. Sorry. I'm moving to zone 4 in Wisconsin at the end of.
Oh, she just dropped off. Christine, give us a call back when you can. I'm sorry about that. We seem to have a telephone malfunction there. Let's do another question. Hopefully, Christine will get back in touch with us. This is a question from Tracy in Mason City. Every year, my two orange trees, 5 feet high in 5 gallon pots, spend the summer outside and then come inside for the winter. The last 2 years, I've had an onset of white flies, aphids in January, only on one plant. Each year, I spray them with eight, a product for white flies, aphids, spider mites, etc., on first sighting infestations, along with the first application prior to coming inside for the winter. Do I need to repot the plants prior to bringing them in so I don't have this problem again?
Repotting is a horticultural question, but it has nothing to do with the insects. Spider mites, aphids, white flies are part of the natural world. You've taken your house plants outside. You brought the plant to the bugs, and they have taken advantage of that. When we talk about bringing those house plants back inside, we frequently mention do a thorough check. Go over them and look. And if you find anything suspicious, an insecticide would be appropriate to reduce the population while it's still small. I'm going to suggest that the caller use insecticidal soap rather than a synthetic insecticide like permethrin, the active ingredient in 8. And because those critters are on the undersides of the leaves, you have to spray up from the underside, not spray down from the top like we normally think of treating a plant. So insecticidal soap to the underside of the leaves when you bring those plants in should be a good prevention for that problem that shows up later.
All right, let's try this again with Christine in Storm Lake. Hi, Christine.
Yes, hi. Thanks. Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to be moving to Zone 4 in central Wisconsin the end of November, and I'm wondering if I can take any of my perennials, such as I've got a couple of hosta plants and a couple of iris rhizomes that I'd like to take with me, but probably won't be able to plant until spring. Is there a way I can do that, and how can I do that?
Boy, that's going to be difficult because storage-wise, they don't store indoors very well. So what you possibly could do is right now dig those up, put them in large pots, especially the hostas, and kind of pot them up. And then bring them to your new location. Hopefully the ground will not be frozen when you get there. And then I would dig a hole and set the pots in the ground. And then I would take maybe some hardware cloth, some chicken wire fencing, and make a cylinder around all the plants, and then fill that with straw so they have some winter protection. And hopefully they'll survive, and if they do, you can plant them next spring.
That's great. Thank you so much for your advice.
Thanks a lot for your call, Christine. Next up, let's go to Dan in Ames. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Just a second. Turn this radio off.
All right. Dan, what's your question?
About spiders. Every time this time of year, I've got a really big yard. I live out just outside of Ames, and I'll see these little spiders that are getting blown across the field and see their webs all over. I wasn't sure if there's kind of a migration of baby spiders or what. I was just curious about it.
We have seen this in the fall of the year, and we think this is an anomaly. And so you are now among the lucky few people walking the earth who have seen this, where those eggs of spiders that were supposed to stay until spring hatch in the fall of the year. And yes, spiders do transport by ballooning. That is, the little baby spiderlings make a strand of silk and it floats in the air, and when the breeze picks them up, they can be blown across the county. They also are making a lot of silk, and it sometimes covers the lawn, sometimes it'll cover your patio furniture from these hatching spiderlings. So two things are happening. One is they're probably not supposed to be here at this time of the year, but they are. The second thing is, yes, this is their dispersal method, is to blow in the wind.
All right. Dan, thanks a lot for your call. We actually had a very similar email question as well from Terry in Cuba City, Wisconsin. He said, this time of year, I always see thousands of tiny white baby spiders dropping out of the sky and sailing cross country on their little strands of webbing. What kind of spiders are they, and what do they look like as adults? So they're not supposed to be doing that this time of year?
It just seems like it's wrong, but it must work for them in some way. Most of these, I assume, are the orb weaver spiders, the garden spider, the cat face spider that we talked about earlier. And yes, they blow in the wind, but they also will just cover the ground with silk. So it's a phenomenon that happens. We've got pictures of it on our website occasionally where someone has reported they got up in the morning, their lawn was covered with spider silk, and they also noticed them then blowing in the wind. So the spiders are blowing in the wind, just like the answer.
All right. Here's a question from Tim. He says, is there any truth to the tale that hedge apples will repel spiders and rid your house of them?
Again.
That was a good response.
Again, no. Hedge apples will work for spider control if you're accurate enough to throw the hedge apple and hit the spider directly. But laying them around the outside of your house, we can't find that that makes any difference. If you cut them in half and put them inside your house, we can't tell that that makes any difference. Now, the interesting news is there are chemicals inside the hedge apple that may be repellent to certain kinds of insects. And we proved this at Iowa State University by steam distilling the chemical out of the hedge apple, putting it on filter paper, and noticing that the cockroaches didn't want to stand there. So there is something in hedge apples, but just placing them around the outside of your house, even after you bought them for a buck a piece at the farmer's market, is not going to make any difference.
And maybe you shouldn't spend a buck on them?
You know, if you think they're pretty, if it makes you feel good, who am I to say how you should spend your money?
All right. Let's go to Joanne in Coal Valley, Illinois. Hi, Joanne.
Well, good morning. I'm calling about rhubarb, please.
Okay.
I noticed mine looks like a lot of it has died out by now. And I'm wondering if this was a bad year for rhubarb plants, and I've had them for years. And would this be a good time to replace it? And also, would you comment on hummingbirds and robins? Have they left the Midwest?
As far as the rhubarb, as far as I know, we've had a good year in general. It is late in the year. And so they're basically starting to decline. But as far as if you want to plant some new rhubarb, I would wait till spring. If you want to transplant some rhubarb, I would do it early in the spring, just as new growth begins to emerge from the ground.
All right. And hummingbirds and robins are not really your area of expertise. They did stick around a little longer this year than normal, but I think mostly hummingbirds have been on their way. And robins, we see every once in a while throughout the winter months. So.
Yes. Yeah. To the hummingbird question, there's an interesting citizen science project called Journey North. And Journey North collects data from people who just want to report. I follow Journey North because they track the monarch migration northward, as their name implies. They also track the migration southward. They also have a site for hummingbird migration. So if you just Google search Journey North Hummingbird, you come up with the story of where the hummingbirds are now, according to the citizen scientists' reports.
All right, Joanne, thank you so much for your call. Next up, we've got Michael in Ames. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I had a question again about brown recluses, and I know you already covered them, and I appreciate that. I'm actually from Lawrence, Kansas, so we've got quite a bit of a larger population there. But I've heard that there are look-alike brown recluses that even have something similar to a fiddle on their back. Is there any truth to this?
Well, you're right about Kansas and Nebraska, or Kansas and Missouri are farther south, and they are down in the native territory for brown recluse spiders, and so they get to talk about it much more than we do. My experience talking with the public is any brown spider will be called brown recluse, but there are some that do carry a little more similarity. The thing to remember about brown recluse is it's a small spider. The body length is only about a quarter to 3/8 of an inch, but then they have these huge, long, thread-like legs, and they have a more of a tan color rather than a brown color. But as you say, they have this fiddle or guitar-shaped mark on their back. There is something called the false brown recluse spider, just like there are false black widow spiders. But yes, there are a bunch of those small brown spiders that at first glance may appear similar, but you do know how the final step in identifying a brown recluse spider, you do know the final answer, don't you? Brown recluse.
Is it the fiddle?
The fiddle is a great figure, a great thing to look at. But ultimately, the proof that it's a brown recluse spider is you stare them in the face, they only have six eyes.
Okay.
Oh.
All the other spiders have eight eyes, and the brown recluse spider has six eyes. So you just have to get close enough with your hand lens to...
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
I think I'll stay away from that. I appreciate it, though.
All right. Well,
thank you for your answer.
Glad to help.
Thanks a lot for your call, Michael. All right. Next up, we've got Mary in Des Moines. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a question about allium bulbs. I've had mine in the ground for 3 years. They come up every spring with, and I've gotten bigger clumps every year of wonderful foliage, but they have never put up a stalk and a flower.
Okay.
Is there something I can do this fall that might change that?
Okay. Do these typically have that ball-like flower head with kind of pinkish-purple flowers, typically?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and these are like the almost the giant ones. They get quite tall and.
Okay. But they come up. They send up foliage, but no flowers. Correct.
No stalk or flowers. Yes.
Okay. Well, do they get enough sun? They typically need at least 6 hours of sun per day.
Yes, they do.
Okay.
I will say the soil isn't wonderful where I live now, but.
Okay. So basically what they have to do is when they come up, you have that foliage, and the foliage has to produce enough food before it dies back to bloom the next spring or the next year. And so for some reason, they're not storing enough food. They're so weak, they're not able to bloom. And typically that's a lack of sunlight where they don't get enough sun. I guess I would try maybe planting some additional bulbs next year in a better site as far as soil and possibly full sun and see how they do. You could also maybe fertilize these early next spring a little bit as they're coming up. Make sure the foliage does not die back prematurely and see what they eventually do. But I think I'd plant some another bulbs next year.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Charlie on Twitter says, I have a potted olive tree that was doing just fine until about 2 months ago. It started dropping all of its leaves. I had an issue with scale mites that seems to be under control. Is the leaf drop seasonal or is my tree doomed?
I think it's stress related, and the mites may have been a factor, the scale may have been a factor, but maybe it was lack of moisture or something of that nature. And so under stress, they drop their leaves. If they have no leaves at this point, it may have expired possibly.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Jeff is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. What about the centipedes, house centipedes? I live in a 100-year-old house. Are they 100-year-old centipedes?
No. Each one you see, the full-grown ones that you see that are about an inch and a quarter in length, they're about 1 year old. And it takes about a year for the house centipedes to grow to that size. Then they come out and walk across the countertop. They get flattened with the newspaper or the bottom of your house slipper, and they don't get to live to ripe old age. They constantly reproduce, and every once in a while, it's not common to see a baby house centipede, but it does happen. Every once in a while, you'll see one that's only a quarter to a half inch long trying to grow up to that full inch and a quarter size.
Okay. Well, as far as the question about the olive tree, maybe it's because the olive tree is in winter and from the southwest or something.
Well, it shouldn't have dropped previously. I mean, it would in the fall, but it shouldn't have dropped in late summer, I wouldn't think.
Now, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Julia in Marion. Should I cut off my hosta foliage or just let it lie?
I basically wait until it's been destroyed by a hard freeze. For most of those, they haven't done that. Typically, once they've frozen and they're kind of laying on the ground and they start to rot, you can usually go out and just kind of pull on them, mm-hmm. and they come right out of the ground.
All right. And here's from Laura in Fort Dodge. This is the second year for my rose tree, one of those ornamentals with a ball-shaped top of roses on a bare stalk, about 5 to 6 feet tall. This spring, there were shoots coming up around the base that I allowed to grow. They ended up coming up to the height of the rest of the tree and flowered beautifully. What would be the pruning method for the plant?
Well, if you want to save those, you would leave those. As far as the bottom branches, we may have to get back to that.
Pick up after the break. All right, we will hit that after the break. You are listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio with me, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. You're welcome to ask your question at 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist and Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. Donald Lewis, they are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get back to that rose tree.
Right.
I can reread the question for people who may have missed it before. This is the second year for my rose tree, one of those ornamentals with a ball-shaped top of roses on a bare stalk, about 5 to 6 feet tall. This spring, there were shoots coming up around the base. I allowed them to grow. They came up to the height of the rest of the tree and flowered beautifully. How should I prune?
Now, those are not very common in Iowa because they're very hard to overwinter. And typically what they do is they graft or bud the desired variety on top of this stalk. And that's why you have this growth on the very top. If you get some growth from the base, that's usually from a different rose or different variety. And so the flower is going to be different. So if that's the case, if you have different flowers on the top and bottom, you definitely have two different types. And the question would be, what do you want to keep? If you just want the very top to bloom, then those bottom canes should be removed. If you don't remove them, I think they're eventually going to become the dominant plant, and the top portion may die out. So if you want that, that's fine. But I think eventually, if you don't remove those bottom canes, they will take over.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Next up, we've got Jack in Ames. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I had a question about getting my lawn ready for the winter. I've heard some people say you should let it grow a little longer, and others say you should mow it a little shorter. So I was wondering about that, and also if there's some kind of for-the-winter fertilizer I should put on.
Okay. As far as mowing it, I would be mowing it at a height of 2.5 to 3 inches right now in the fall. I would continue to mow as long as the grass is growing, and the grass typically stops growing in the fall when we typically have temperatures consistently in the 40s during the day, 20s at night. That's usually early November. And with all the moisture, I think it's going to keep on growing until then. So keep on mowing it. As far as fertilization, actually early November is a good time to do it. And you don't need a special fertilizer. You can use a typical lawn fertilizer that is largely nitrogen, has no phosphate in it, and little or no potash in it. So a typical lawn fertilizer is fine. You don't have to buy a so-called winterizer fertilizer. It's not necessary.
All right, Jack, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Karen with another lawn question. Hi, Karen.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if it's too late to put weed and feed on the yard?
It is not. So if you're using a broadleaf herbicide fertilizer combination product, I would probably wait and do it in early November. And when you're applying that type of product, you want to do it when the foliage is wet, because you need those particles to stick to the foliage. So early in the morning after a heavy dew would be great. Put it on at that point.
All right, Karen, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to another Karen in Iowa City this time. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, I think this is me, Karen from Adel. Oh. And we've been walking around noticing that the lilac bushes have been blooming, even though there's no foliage on them. So I'm wondering how that's going to affect them in the spring. And then also, we have been inundated, luckily, with praying mantis inside and out of our home, and just wondered if that maybe came in from a plant or it's something fun that's going to start happening in Iowa. Thanks.
Well, as far as some of the plants blooming, the flower buds typically form in midsummer, and they normally stay dormant. But over the last few days, I've seen a few flowers on serviceberry, on viburnum, on crabapple, and even on our rhododendron. And I think what may have happened was that we had a very dry spell there in midsummer, and I think some of the plants went kind of semi-dormant. And in fact, some plants, because they had a disease, they dropped their leaves early, and that put the plants under stress. And then with all the abundant rainfall in September and October, they've kind of resumed growth, and some of these flowers have been coaxed to bloom. So if that happens, obviously you're going to have fewer flowers next spring, but as far as the plants, they should be fine.
And as far as the praying mantis, it's always a great time when you can find a praying mantis. They are a southern insect, as in Georgia, Louisiana, Alabama, so forth. But we get them as far north now as Waterloo and Mason City. But when I started 40 years ago, it was hard to find a praying mantis anywhere north of the southern tier of counties. So over the years, they have appeared farther north. They usually barely survive our winters. You'll find the egg cases outside, but it appears that they don't often make it through a hard, severe winter. But they do repopulate in the fall, in the summer, the spring and summer, when new praying mantis are either blown into the state or they crawl into the state, or they come in with purchased egg cases that other gardeners are purchasing and putting out. All our praying mantids are going to die in the fall, so enjoy them while you got them. If they're inside, they might have ridden in with a plant or they might have walked in, but they're not going to last for long, so enjoy them while you got them.
All right. I went on a hike in a prairie in the Iowa City area a little over a week ago, and it was crawling with praying mantises. It was pretty exciting.
It's pretty exciting. They were all the full-grown, 4 to 6 inch long
ones?
Yeah. That's called the Chinese mantis. It was introduced into the United States and is now found throughout the eastern two-thirds of the United States, but again, the southern part more commonly.
All right. Let's go next to Yusupa in Des Moines. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, my question is from the Gambia, West Africa. My brother sent me a picture of some kind of insects that are eating up his banana plant and also the orange plant. So I just wanted to see how I can connect with Richard to show him a video of this insect that is actually eating up all their plants, banana plants, orange plant, anything, and it's got some white stuff that comes out of the spit or some kind of a thing that it makes like a wax thing, just like spiders, but it's not a spider.
Right.
So I don't know if I need to upload this thing on a video or something.
We'll leave Richard out of this one.
Right. And, focus on Donald here.
You can send this to me. I'm not promising that I'll be able to identify an African insect, but tropical insects are something that we have seen occasionally during our study abroads and so forth. So here's the email address to send the video. You can attach it to an email and send it to insects, plural, I-N-S-E-C-T-S, insects at iastate.edu. And we'll look at that. We'll share it around the department. We'll see if we can come up with a name for you. And then we'll try to connect you to a tropical entomologist who might be able to help with the control measures.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. Next up, let's go to Irene in Kelowna. Hi, Irene.
Hi. I have some fig trees that are supposed to be winter hardy, and, well, they're called Chicago. And I have them in pots.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know how I can keep them alive over the winter, because it said the roots should be hardy to 10 below, but in Iowa, I don't know that that's going to be good enough.
Yeah.
And they're big pots, so I don't know that I want to bring them inside.
Well, what I would do is, if you have like an unheated garage, that would be a mm-hmm. great place to put it over winter. So maybe bring it inside by early November, leave it there all winter long, and hopefully it will survive. But it's not really a house plant, and so someplace where it's cool, but it doesn't get uh-huh. extremely cold.
Right. What about the light situation, if there's no windows? Or...
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. I'm mainly worried okay. about the temperature. I would love to okay. have a site where the temperatures are basically 30s, 40s, maybe upper 20s, perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Irene. Next up, we've got Jeff in Davenport. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a small patch of butterfly weed, milkweed, and I was wondering, this year I didn't see any seeds on it, and also I was wondering if I should cut down the stalks or just leave them up there.
Well, you can cut down the stalks early next spring. That's perfectly fine. Did it flower this year?
Yes, it did. I had okay. a lot of activity around it, too, but there just doesn't seem to be any, there wasn't any seeds like there has been in yeah. the past.
Yeah.
Normally
you might see one or two pods. I mean, you might have several flowers in a cluster, but maybe only one or mm-hmm. two then is pollinated and then forms that pod. But apparently
yes.
this plant didn't get very good pollination, and therefore none of the flowers uh-huh. developed into pods. But they hopefully will next year.
So I should just leave the stalks up then this in fall, just leave them up through the winter?
I would, and then cut them back in late March.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Jeff. Let's do a few email questions here. From Karen in Mason City, I found a swallowtail caterpillar in my farmer's market dill and wondered mm-hmm. what the best thing to do would be to help this little guy. Is it too chilly to put him back outside?
Wow, that's a tough one. The black swallowtail, the celery worm that's on dill and carrots and other things like that, spends the winter as a chrysalis. And so that caterpillar should have stayed on the plants, and then it would form a little loop of silk, and it would hang there a couple feet off the ground and manage to survive the winter exposed that way. So I would put the caterpillar back outside on a sunny day, hope it finds a stem that it can climb up onto and make that chrysalis, and keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best.
All right, here's another caterpillar question from Jackie. A Luna moth caterpillar fell from my maple tree yesterday. It has since cocooned. How do I make sure it will live till next spring?
Leave it alone. Maybe move it to the brush pile, move it to the edge where there's a bunch of tall grass or some ground cover. They do spend the winter as cocoons, usually kind of wrapped in a leaf and covered with silk. They spend the winter in that cocoon stage, so it's adapted for staying outside. We want to leave it outside so that it doesn't emerge prematurely by the heat of the house. So move it to a sheltered location, maybe put it behind your wood pile, someplace where it can rest for the winter and resume activity in the spring.
All right, TJ is on the line next in Denver. Hi, TJ.
Hi there. I've got an oak tree that this year had a lot of dead leaves. I would call them like offshoot branches, but most of the tree was healthy, but quite a few little branches with like three or four dead oak leaves on them. Was that due to the wet spring we had, or what caused that?
Did that begin to show up in mid to late summer?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. There's a twig canker that has been very, very common this year, where the tips of the branches, typically no more than maybe 6 to 8 inches, suddenly die, and there are several
right.
leaves attached to it, and they're kind of sporadic through the canopy. Here and there, there's one of those. We're seeing that here in Ames on campus here at Iowa State. It's very, very common, typically on the red oaks. So it's a type of canker, very, very common this year. And I think the weather does play a part in the occurrence of it, the severity of it. There's really nothing to do. In most cases, the tree should be fine, but it is very, very easy to spot when it occurs in mid to late summer.
Right, yeah, because there's quite a few branches with the dead leaves on it.
Yep.
Okay, and so they're
gonna,
don't worry about it.
And they're going to hang on basically most of this fall and into winter, while the other leaves will fall off. So you'll see these well into winter.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Interesting. All right, so nothing to worry about then.
Not at this point, nope.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Linda in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a question about cleaning up tomato cages and the posts that you secure them in the ground with. And I'm hoping you don't tell me I need to scrub them with hot soapy water and a stiff brush.
No, I would just go out with a brush and just scrape off any debris that might be clinging to it.
Sanitation is not necessary. You don't have to bleach them.
No. Just with a brush. There might be some debris that might cling to those, the pole or the cage. Kind of just brush it off.
Oh, that's easy then. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Linda. Nice to make somebody's day, right? Here's a question from Al in Ankeny. I'm growing something I don't want to grow. That's in all caps. Every late summer following a rain, we have dozens of large brown mushrooms pop up in our medium-sized front lawn in Ankeny. After one rain, I plucked over 70 of them. I'm thinking there's some wood decomposing under the ground somewhere, but the question is there a way to prevent their growth?
No, unfortunately.
Gave Linda the answer she wanted and Al the opposite.
Yep,
that's right.
Basically, that organic matter has to break down totally, and that may take several years. And when the weather conditions are favorable, they're just going to pop up.
All right, let's go to one more phone call. Randy's on the line in Poweshiek, Iowa. Quickly, Randy, what's your question?
Oh, I got oak leaf blight or whatever, and what about these ash trees that are dying? What would be good trees to replace those two species with next year?
All right, so good trees to replace oak and ash.
I would look at linden. They're very, very common, very easy to grow. I would look at the various maples. I would look at hackberries. I would look at honey locust. So a number of different trees that you can plant that do just fine.
All right. But nothing, the key is diversity, right?
Yes, and nothing is totally pest-free, unfortunately.
All right, a lesson we have to learn again and again. Okay, last question. We'll squeeze this one in from Aaron. Something keeps pulling up the grass in my yard, pulling up the turf in clumps. Any guess what is doing this and why?
Raccoons
or skunks?
Skunks.
All right. Looking for grubs. Or
black bears looking for grubs. Could be foxes. Could be armadillos. But there may be grubs in the ground, and that's a food source for skunks and raccoons, and they love to eat them.
All right. And what's the long term consequence of that?
Replace the sod and hope for the best.
All right. Richard Duran and Donald Lewis, thank you both so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. We'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. We had production assistance today from Julia DiGiacomo. And you can follow us on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio. Find us on Twitter @Iowa Public Radio as well. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.